We're going to continue with the book of Zechariah. This is the prophets of the restoration. We're going to work through Zechariah 1, verses 7 through 21. Last time we looked at those introductory verses, those verses really help us understand that Zechariah's prophecy is interlinked with that of Haggai. But it's going to continue beyond that, at least in terms of what is written. And so as we look at this tonight, we'll take note at the time frame, because we do have, again, a time frame here. We can see that already as we move into this first vision, we're going to be looking at the first and second visions. The first vision already tells us that we've moved several months beyond Haggai's ministry, at least as it is recorded in the book. These two visions appear to be either simultaneous or in very close proximity. The dating of the first appears to be the dating of the second, and may well be the dating of a number of these visions. We don't know how many of these were seen at once, but we're really only given this date at this point, and then we'll see some other dating later in the book when we move into the sermonic or the didactic section on fasting. So we're going to begin looking at the dating. We're going to begin looking at that, and I want to point out a few things about this dating and about the structure of the book as we move into it. We're going to begin looking at verse 7. So we're going to begin with Zechariah 1, verse 7.
Zechariah 1, verse 7. Upon the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month of Sivat, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying.
Okay, so the first thing that we're told is that the prophecy here is 3 months after the preceding prophecy. And we're told specifically it's the ninth month, which is Sivat. That month actually straddles our months of February and March. The 24th day of the month means that this is, in all likelihood, into what we would now call March. It's later in that month. Now, how did they do this? Why do they have this reckoning? There are a couple things we need to remember. Even with our calendar, which is a solar calendar, the first of the year actually used to begin March 1st. In the 1600s, there was a revision. January and February were placed at the beginning. They used to be the last 2 months of the year. That's why December is December. It's the 10th month, not the 12th month. October is the 8th month. November is the 9th month. December is the 10th month. The reckoning was such that the year was viewed as ending at the end of what we now call February, which is also has something to do with why that leap year goes in. We put the day at the end of February. We're reconciling the whole year. Anyhow, the Jews use what is called a lunar calendar. And the lunar calendar is measured from new moon to new moon. Now, that a new moon is when the moon is positioned directly between the sun and the earth. The only time we really see that is when there's an eclipse. That's the only time we really notice it. What we normally see is a little sliver of the sun behind the moon. Only when we have an eclipse do we see the moon is actually right in front of the sun. So the illuminated part of the moon in a new moon is actually behind on the side that we can't see. It's always struck me as somewhat interesting that the ceremonial calendar was lunar. In the book of Revelation, if you remember, there was a woman with the moon under her feet. The foundation was the moon. The Old Testament economy was, and we're told, it was intended to be, shadowy and typical. So the moon, we already know from Genesis, is a lesser light. And that's exactly what the Old Testament is. It's a lesser light in the sky. The fact that it is interposed, their calendar's running from the interposition of this lesser light between the earth and the greater light, I think also has some significance. Just in the natural course of things, it's showing really where this Old Testament revelation stands in the ordering of things. So their calendar is, in fact, based on this lunar cycle. And that's why I've mentioned before some of these months that are mentioned, they're not really running from January 1st to January 31st or February 1st to February 28th or 9th. That's not the way they're thinking about it. That's not the way this is coming to pass because the lunar calendar is ruled by the new moon. It's following that. So that's also why it is where it is. I said the ninth month. It's the 11th month, we're told here, which is Sebat. And that's also why it's the 11th month, because really, around the time we're coming to the end of the year, the prophecy that we get is still, we're told, during the second year of the reign of Darius. Now, just for point of reference, some of the prophecies in the book of Daniel are actually given, I believe Daniel 11 is given in the first year of Darius. So the years are being dated in terms of regal years, who's king, which dynasty's in power, and the months are regulating the ceremonial and sacrificial cycles for the Jewish church. Now, in this period, on the 24th day of the 11th month, we're told the word of the Lord came unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, I want you to take note of the language here. And we've seen this several times. Came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai. This is language that we find, particularly in the prophets of the Reformation, or Restoration, I should say, this comes up several times, this language. In fact, numerous times. If we consider the language as it stands, what we're being told is this: the word of the Lord came to him and said something to him. Now, it might just be sort of a prolix way of referring to the prophetic message coming to the prophet. But I think it seems better, and some of the rabbis and the Targums and a number of other things, they're going to put in place of this the word Memra. They're going to understand it as being an appearance of the one that we identify as the second person of the Trinity, the Son. And that has, I think, some interesting implications. It's telling us, among other things, as we'll see, that all of these prophetic messages are being mediated through the Son. When we talk about Christ, we talk about him as prophet, priest, and king. And here we can see very clearly he's operating as a great prophet of his church. Now, in addition to noting that, I just want to remind you that we already looked at this last time, but Zechariah is a prophet who happens to be descended from a priestly family. So he has interest in this rebuilding of the temple, the whole project, from a couple of different points of view. It's interesting, I think, for a couple of reasons. As a priest, he would have been much more conversant in those typical and shadowy usages that we identify with the Old Testament dispensation of the covenant of grace. As a prophet, he is going to be looking across that typology, being given a vision of the great antitype, and he's going to be in a better position than, say, just a prophet like Haggai, to understand some of the more far-reaching implications of what he's saying. Mainly because he's going to have a better sense of what is possible and could possibly comport with the typical economy, and what parts of the prophecy, in fact, are arguing that this is looking way beyond that, way into the future. So I think he's in a better place to see that, and I suspect that's one reason why he, of all three of them, gets the most extensive revelation. If we look at Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, Zechariah is given more information than both Haggai and Malachi together. So what we have then in the first verse is this. We've got a designation of the time when this vision occurs, and we have a declaration of the authority whereby this vision occurs. All right, so we know that from verse 7. Verse 7 is very important. It's clearly carrying us beyond the ministry of Haggai now. We're moving beyond, if you think about this now, we're moving beyond the initial push to get people interested in rebuilding the temple. And so, what is it that he sees? Well, we need to begin looking at verse 8.
Zechariah 1, verse 8. I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom, and behind him were there red horses, speckled and white.
Okay, so, now, what we can say is this. This first vision is a vision that's given. It's intended to encourage the people of God who are already rebuilding the temple, but their condition is lowly, right? It's a degraded condition. They're not in the best way. They're doing what they're supposed to do now, But the condition for operation, the condition for pushing forward in this project, it's simply not the best. So, he has a night vision. And it's a night vision for one of two reasons, perhaps both are involved. But remember, this is the economy that's more like the moon. That this is not as illuminating as the full sunlight. There's also perhaps the idea here that even in that economy, this is a dark time. Whatever the source of the darkness, we're assured that it's there. And it's against the backdrop of the darkness that he has his vision. Now, the myrtle trees, they represent the church as it was at that time, particularly the theocracy of the Jews, that church-state relation that they had. And it's very interesting. Myrtle trees are kind of interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, they're lowly, they're more like bushes. If we remember the vision of Daniel, which we'll come back to in a moment, Nebuchadnezzar is like a big tree, and all the fowls of the air take up their abode in his branches. These kingdoms that have ruled the world, they're like trees, but the church at this time in particular is not like a tree. Not like a cedar tree or some sort of big tree. It's more like a myrtle, which is a glorified shrub, if you will. And myrtles also have this interesting feature. They're covered with flowers, but the flowers don't really give off any strong scent until they're crushed. So you not only have to brush up against them, you have to damage the bush in order to get the smell, the fragrance. Note, too, the location of these myrtle trees in this vision. They're said to be in the bottom or in a valley. Okay, so they're not on top of a hill. This is not a mountain. It's the opposite of a mountain. You know, at the time of Christ's coming, every mountain is going to be laid low, every valley brought up. It's going to be smooth. That represents a switch. You know, prior to Christ's coming, the church is in a valley. It's prophesied to be a mountain, but it's in a valley. And the man who is riding here is Christ. He's been represented in his kingly office. That's why he's on a horse. The particular horse he's riding at the moment is a red horse. And that represents war and destruction. We've talked about this a bit. In fact, these horses, the vision of the horses, is taken up and expounded in a little bit more detail in Revelation. He's on a red horse because he's just presided, if you remember. He's presided over the Babylonian conquering and captivity of the people of God. Now, it's interesting that although he is, in fact, in charge of providence, he is riding here in the same valley as the church. You should expect. Remember, the scripture tells us that his delights are with the children of the sons of men. He is identifying with his people. That's also why he's portrayed here as a man. This is a pre-incarnate glimpse of Christ. in his mediatorial office. His incarnation is the basis of his mediation. Now, the horses that are behind him, they represent the judgments that he sends, or the mixed mercies and the victories that he sends. And it tells us all of these ultimately, they're following in his train, they're serving him, he's Messiah, the Prince, and he's doing it on behalf of the church. All right, we want to look at verse 9.
Zechariah 1, verse 9. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel that talked with me said unto me, I will show thee what these be.
So Zechariah sees this vision, and what does he do? And here we begin to see now some of this imagery coming together. He speaks to the word of the Lord, whom he calls Lord, and who is, for the present purposes, also said to be an angel. Now, it's important that we keep all that imagery straight as we go through this. So, who is this? This is an angel. He's the angel of the covenant. He's really the pre-incarnate Christ. He's the same one as the man who is riding upon the horse. So what is it now that Zechariah sees? He sees Christ not only revealed as king over his church in the vision, but here he turns to him and he relies on him as prophet to expound to him the meaning of the vision. In other words, the same person who is represented as king of the church, riding on horseback, is speaking to the prophet in order to give interpretation here. The same one who is the angel, Zechariah calls the Lord. And although the King James does not have that capitalized, I would suggest that it's better that this be capitalized. He knows who it is with whom he's conversing. And we'll see that in the next couple of verses. It's going to become very clear who's in view. He's calling him Lord. He's the angel of the covenant. We're also going to see in a moment that this is just not a base assertion on my part, but it's actually quite clear in this vision. He is that man. He's the same one as the man riding on the horse. Oh, and by the way, he's identified here as the word of the Lord. Now, that's a lot to put together, but it's there. Look now at verse 10.
Zechariah 1, verse 10. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth.
Okay, so the angel says, I'm going to show you what these are. And now the man standing among the myrtle trees begins to speak. You're asking, what is the meaning of this vision? And now the man in the vision starts to speak to you. So the identification of the angel that spoke with Zechariah with the man should be relatively clear here. Christ is the king and the head of his people. He's also, however, we see, prophet and teacher of the church. He's also called here the angel, again, because Christ is the head of the angels of God. He's the chief or the Lord of hosts. Now he frames an answer that in fact is designed to meet the very needs of the question that have been proposed by the prophet. You know, he could do anything with this, but no, this is an answer that's fitted. And here begins, I think, a need to look at this and see a little bit more at work that we're going to talk about momentarily. That is, if there's some intercession going on. You're getting an answer that fits hand in glove, fits that which is being asked. Right. He's not asking one question and getting a different answer. So, what we have now is this. We can see the ignorance of the prophet. You know, he's seen this vision, but he has no idea what this means. And immediately, we also see here that there is an utter dependence of the prophet upon the mediation of Christ to make clear the meaning of the vision. So that Christ is not only held forth to us here as king of his church, but very clearly as prophet to his church and of his church. I'm going to assert as well that there's an intimation of his priestly character, but that will become clear in just a few verses. All right, these other horses, we learn from this verse, actually represent what we would probably call angelic forces who've been sent forth for the supply and defense of the church. They're out there. They're sent into all of the earth in order to make the powers of this world bend and lend all of their support and promote the interests of the church, even though they remain unaware of what they're doing. So the wrath of man is going to praise God. They may not know what they're doing, but the fact is, the providence of God, and I want you to keep this in mind as we get into the next couple of verses, the providence of God is being unfolded in the context of a revelation to the church. But the providence that's being unfolded doesn't simply respect the church, it respects a lot more. Right. So, and we're going to come back to this, but the idea here is already beginning to emerge. It's an idea that should be very familiar if you've read the section, the chapter on providence in the Confession of Faith, that there's a special providence which pertains to the church. There's a sense in which the church is at the center of everything. Everything that's happening is happening for the sake of the people of God. And so everything, you know, these forces are out marching around the world, marching to and fro throughout the earth. Why? Well, to report back. And to report back, as we will see, in a way that actually is to the benefit of the church. Verse 11. Zechariah 1:11. So here, these forces, these who are walking to and fro, they answer the angel of the Lord. Now notice the interchangeability here, how we're moving from the word of the Lord saying to Zechariah saying, "Oh Lord," talking to the angel of the covenant, talking, the man that's riding the horse is talking. Now we're back to the angel of the Lord. It's all the same one, considered under just slightly different different connections, really. So what do we see, and why is he called the angel of the Lord? Well, probably because what we're actually seeing here is the angels are serving Messiah, who is, by way of eminence and preeminence, the head of the angels. He is the angel of the Lord. He is the angel of the covenant. And all the angels are going to serve him in that capacity. So, as I say, providence revolves around the interests of the church. Right? It is the purpose of all things to serve the mediator, and the mediator, the focus of the mediator is on the church, because it's his body. And that's not simply something that is peculiar, by the way, to this period of time or that period of time. This is a view that should be held at all times, because providence is always going to revolve around the interests of the church. It always has been this way. It always will be this way. And all of history is made to serve Messiah as king of his church. Now, what's interesting here, I think, is this. We're told that they've done his bidding. They did. They were to walk to and fro in all of the earth, and they've done it. And now they bring back a report. By the way, it's, I think, of some interest that what we refer to as eschatology, what we refer to as prophecy, and the interpreting of providence, all of this is really instigated. The bringing back of this report that starts the next chain of events is instigated by the church and what the church is doing. Now, I say that because God is, yes, he sent Zechariah in the church, but Zechariah is a prophet in the church, he's standing between God and man, and he makes this request for this information. The report that they bring is this. Basically, they say, look, everywhere we go, the whole earth is in a state of peace. All the nations are experiencing peace and prosperity. Contrast that with where Zechariah was as he's hearing this. This is just at the end of the 70 years and the beginning of the return from captivity. Judea was desolate. Jerusalem was in ruins because of all that had happened at the leading up to the captivity. At this point, the only thing that might be a little bit of an encouragement on Israel's side of the ledger is that the temple is at least now being rebuilt. Ultimately, what that means is this, though. If all that we're looking at is uninterpreted providences, we're just focused on what we see. Providence, according to the report of these angels, providence actually seems to be quite contrary to the promises of God toward the church. We would have never thought that it would get that bad. We would never think that God would take it quite that far. Well, unless we were paying attention. because they were warned. Look at verse 12.
Zechariah 1:12. Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years?
No sooner does he get this report from the angels than Christ, remember he's the angel of the Lord, he turns on behalf of man and he begins to make intercession. In other words, he begins to behave like a priest. He does so on behalf of his people. But here the angel of the covenant, he's a man, remember, among the myrtle trees, to whom the very angels answer. And he cries out to the Lord of hosts, which in this place, I think we need to understand that the Lord of hosts is represented in this covenant transaction by the Father. So ultimately, we're going to see in the Bible that the Lord of hosts is referring to the Son of God incarnate. But there is a mediation going on where Christ is mediating here between God and man. And so you have to understand that that mediation is personal, and it's mediating between the human nature and the divine nature. And that's really what's pictured here. So, Lord of hosts, we're talking about the Son of God as to his divinity in particular. Note, too, I think very interestingly, the objects of this intercession. He doesn't start to pray or intercede for all men. He's concerned with certain men, those who dwell in Jerusalem and cities of Judah. And he begins to argue a couple of different ways in this intercession. First, he's arguing from the providence, which has been reported by these angels that have gone to and fro. And then he also begins to argue based on the promise of God implied in this idea that at the end of 70 years I will visit you and you will return. So it was time. They're at the end of the 70 years. And that's why this comes up. It's time for God to begin to work on behalf of his people. So the intercession begins. Note as well, the intercession for the people of God doesn't begin any sooner than the prophecy allows. So it's important that we have a sense, a knowledge of prophecy. It's also important that we have our finger on providence so that we're able to argue both. And certainly this is what Christ does, making intercession for his people. In verse 13,
the Lord answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words.
The Lord answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. We see here the intercession of Christ is always heard. Right? The divinity, the deity. There's a response. Not only is it answered, though, in this case, but we see, really, when Christ intercedes, the answer is going to be in a manner like this. It's going to be good and comfortable. And what follows are the words recorded by the prophet in the next four verses. So the rest of this vision is actually it's actually spelling out what it was that Zechariah heard the Lord answer this angel. Verse 14.
Zechariah 1, verse 14. But the angel that communed with me said unto me, Cry thou, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with great jealousy.
Okay, what do we need to understand here? Well, again, Zechariah is informed by the angel of the answer. Who is the angel? Christ. He's communing with Christ. By communing here, really is just meant speaking. And he's receiving that message by the mouth of the angel. And it's interesting. Having made the argument and getting this answer, this good and comfortable answer, the answer to this intersection of providence and promise is this. Christ tells Zechariah to cry aloud. What he's telling him is to proclaim or preach the message. What this tells us as well is that the whole idea of the good news, the gospel, the good news about the church, all of this is really the result of Christ's intercession. Now this all begins, that is to say, this proclamation. Begins with reference to Jerusalem and Zion. In other words, the concern ultimately is for the church. And we're told here the Lord is jealous. Now that language is in fact very significant. Jealousy is something that is a disposition that pertains to one who is a spouse. And so what he's referring to here with his jealousy, he's really in a backhanded way referring to the covenant that he has with his people. It's like a marriage bond. And their defection has evoked jealousy. He's jealous because he's betrothed to them. He's jealous because it's his bride. Right, he's jealous because there's this marital type covenant. So the implication, I think, is this. He's already, as he begins to frame a sense of the outcome, he's already saying, look, that Babylonian captivity, that wasn't so much a matter of anger. Right? It wasn't just angry destruction. It wasn't just losing my temper. It was a result of jealousy. It was a result of chastening love, really. We want to move on to verse 15.
Zechariah 1, verse 15. And I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they held for the affliction.
Now we can see a little bit of contrast coming into play. What we see is the great displeasure of God against the enemies of the church. And what bothers God, we're told here, is this. The heathen live their lives at ease in a world that's troubled by sin. They don't care much, if any, for the things of God, and they certainly don't care for the welfare of his church. So, what does this do? Well, this means that although God raises them up to be rods of his chastisement, These enemies of God's people always fail to see what should be obvious. Just because God raises you up to use you to punish his people does not mean you are the recipient of divine favor. Doesn't mean you found favor with God. And it's delusional to move from the one to the other, to think that, oh, because God is going to use me to beat up on his people, therefore, he must really be loving me now. Apart from Christ, there's no peace with God. There's no peace for the wicked. Right? When we're given the opportunity to chasten the people of God, what they do, the wicked, these rods have been employed, they exhibit more cruelty, less compassion, more anger than they've been given leave to employ. Their motivation ultimately is wrong. Even though they're doing the right thing, God has turned them loose to punish his people. Their motivation is never wrong. They're not doing it to the glory of God. You know, the Babylonians did not go in there thinking, we're going to do all this and we're going to give God the glory for conquering Israel. Not at all. It wasn't even on their radar. Now, I think at least part of the point of this verse is something like this. If they think that God's chastening of his people had been harsh, especially given the hand that they were allowed to have in all of this, that's going to be like nothing compared to the judgments that are going to be poured forth on the enemies of his people. God wanted them to be chastened a little bit, but you helped forward their affliction. You went beyond what was called for. You went beyond the commission, and you did it because you yourselves are enemies of God and his people. Why is that important? Well, remember, Babylon no more remains. Right? Babylon is gone. We're not going to miss the Babylon now, although I would argue that these verses are, in fact, looking through this to mystic Babylon. Babylon no more remains. It's gone. It's been wiped out. On the other hand, the church continues to stretch forth its stakes to fill the whole earth. It's going to continue until the end of time. Right, look at verse 16.
Verse 16, therefore thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies, my house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem.
Okay, so the time of deliverance now, the reason of this, as they're rebuilding the temple, deliverance time had come. The temple's going to be rebuilt. And, by the way, there is an idea here that this is a sign God has been reconciled with his people. In fact, he goes beyond that. He says not only is the temple going to be rebuilt, but, hey, Jerusalem as well will be restored. Jerusalem is going to be built up again. The line stretched forth is talking about a plumb line, measuring line. So the building will begin on that project as well. Notice, however, the verse here says, actually, that before either the temple or the city had been rebuilt, the Lord already said he'd returned. Now, the temple represents the restoring of the worship of God, the building of Jerusalem, the rebuilding of the church. And so when God is promising to rebuild the church, it's really because the people had already begun to restore worship in that church. So when people say, "Oh, how important is this worship issue? How important is the regulative principle? How important is it that we follow after what God says to do in His worship?" It's very important. You know, building up of Jerusalem, the plumb line being laid on the whole city, that's a result of what was already a proffered obedience. Okay, look at verse 17.
Zechariah 1, verse 17. "Cry yet, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, My cities through prosperity shall yet be spared abroad. And the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem."
So here is finally a promise to bring great prosperity to the people of God. And it's a promise we see of enlarging the church and people of God. Here's the problem. We can admit this has some literal fulfillment at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. But this promise is actually taking us well beyond that time. Right? The Lord shall yet comfort Zion, shall yet choose Jerusalem. That's language looking forward to the enlargement of Christ's kingdom under the gospel, when Christ, who's the chief cornerstone laid in Zion, he's part of that building of the church, right? It's especially pointing forward, I believe, to the period of time after the Babylonian captivity of the church, when Mystery Babylon has been in control, to that period of time that we would call the millennium. So this is one of these verses where its fulfillment, the literal fulfillment, doesn't live up to the hype. Another one of these types of verses that I've mentioned here and there. It's sort of not wholly unlike Psalm 72, which is a psalm for Solomon, and we're told that his kingdom will rule from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same, that in every nation kingdom his name would be great. It's talking about Solomon, yes, no. Solomon's kingdom was never like that. Is it talking like about Solomon's kingdom? Typically, yeah. But the antitype, the theological reality is far beyond that, and that's what I'm saying here. There's something beyond this. We have to look through this to a time that's still to come. And this is the last verse of this vision. So what is it telling us? Well, this is exactly why I believe this imagery of these horses comes up in the book of Revelation. Right? It's looking, all you had to do is look back before John, and you should have seen that this is talking about something long after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, or even the time of the Maccabees. This is far beyond that. You can't limit it to that period of time, and in fact, it's going to require a period of time more like we've described the millennium to be, in order for all of this to come to pass. Right, that brings us in to the second vision. This is just a short vision, and it's interesting, I think, in this regard. This too has that quality of exceeding any possibility of literal fulfillment at the time of Zechariah or even soon after. But let's look at verse 18. Zechariah 1:18.
Then lifted I up mine eyes and saw and behold four horns.
Then lifted up mine eyes and saw and behold four horns. So this is the second vision. And I would point out that one more time, at least, Zechariah appears that he's seeing this in the night. This time, however, he sees four horns. Now, this is not too difficult in this respect. We know in the Bible, horns are symbols of power and pride. They represent various powers, political powers. These four horns, well, if they were referring to horns that have already appeared on the scene, then we may well be talking about Egypt, Babylon, Media, and Persia. The number four almost certainly refers to the cardinal points on the compass. So it's sort of a way of saying Israel's continually surrounded or encircled by our enemies. Whichever way we turn, north, south, east, and west, we're in trouble. Now, it is possible that these four horns, at least an initial fulfillment, comes into play with the breakdown of the third kingdom, the Greek kingdom, with the coming into power of Alexander's four generals. They're called four horns in the book of Daniel. And so there may be a more specific reference there, an immediate reference there. But it doesn't really change the point, right? Whichever way they turn. And this is really reinforced in verse 19.
Zechariah 1, verse 19. Then I said unto the angel that talked with me, what be these? And he answered me, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem.
So Christ, again, it's Christ, the angel talking with him, explains these are the powers arrayed against the people of God. You know, he says, these are the enemies that you face, whichever direction you turn. Could be Assyria, Chaldea, Samaria in the north, Egypt in the south, Philistia in the west, Ammon and Moab in the east. The fact is, as we look beyond, we see the same thing. The church has always been said about by enemies, whichever way we look. Now, in contrast to that, the last two verses in this chapter give us another image to keep in mind. So, verse 20.
Verse 20, and the Lord showed me four carpenters.
Okay, so, in response to the first part of the vision, Christ, and note now, all of a sudden here, what is this angel called? It's called the Lord. And that's that covenant name of God. See, so this is taking us all the way full circle with identification now. What is talking to him is the Lord Jehovah. He calls him Lord. He's the man riding among the myrtles. He's the word of the Lord speaking to him. He is the angel of the covenant. It's all the same one. He shows them here four carpenters. Now, the word carpenter is a little bit forced. The Hebrew word means artificers or craftsmen. We don't know. The idea is this. There are four of them because they're opposition to the four horns. And we'll see in a moment that that's exactly what they're going to do. But we don't really know whether these are artificers in metal or in wood. Right? But their job has to do with the horns. So if they're metal horns, well, one thing. If they're wooden horns, something else. So finally, verse 21.
Zechariah 1:21. Then said I, what come these to do? And he spake, saying, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man lift up his head. But these are come to pray them, to cast out the horns of the Gentiles, which lifted up their horns in the land of Judah, and scattered.
Right. So for every horn arrayed against the church, God has set some kind of craftsman to beat it back and counteract it, some artificer. And ultimately, again, this is this overplus of reference in this verse, which tells us it can't simply be talking about Israel at that time, under Ezra and Nehemiah, or even the time of the Maccabees, or even the days of the early church. There's this idea here that when the times of the Gentiles is fulfilled, that there's going to be a building of the church. This began with the early church after the fall of Jerusalem. And by the way, that ended the period of the four kingdoms prophesied by Daniel. There's another four kingdoms that we have to work with. There are a number of possibilities for the four horns. It depends on where we want to look at that, and I wouldn't necessarily rule out either one. I'm only saying that with every prophecy, you've got the type and the antitype. You've got promise, you've got fulfillment. A lot of things going on. So this idea of casting out the horns of the Gentiles, which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it, this idea is ultimately bringing us back to, I think, two ideas. One is the restoration, regathering of the Jews that Paul talks about. And that's going to be prior to the millennium. So he's talking about something that didn't really happen in his time. There was a type of it, it was shadowy, but it wasn't the real event. It was looking forward, looking through. It was conversant with that event, but it was not that event. Okay, next time, what we want to do is we want to look at chapter 2. We're going to try to cover all of chapter 2. A lot of these chapters in Zechariah are pretty good bite-sized units for what we're trying to do in giving a survey of this material. Keep in mind that this is instruction not simply for the church in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. It's also particularly instructive for the church that is regrouping at the end of the reign of mystic Babylon prior to its full establishment during the millennial era. Next time, Lord willing, chapter 2.